Okay, so I'd like to tell you about some work I've been doing recently with Rob Myers on negative anti-de Sitter energy and its implications for large N gauge theories. This work is still in progress, but it seems to have some important implications for this remarkable correspondence that we've been hearing about all week between string theory and anti-de Sitter space and large N gauge theories. So let me begin with the following claim. So I claim that there are smooth solutions to supergravity, and for the purposes of this talk, it'll be sufficient to just consider Einstein's equation with a negative cosmological constant, which asymptotically approach anti-de Sitter space, but have negative total energy. And by that I mean that their energy is less than that of anti-de Sitter space itself. Now this may seem puzzling, because you're probably aware of various positive energy theorems, which are supposed to show that this can happen. Well, indeed, for spacetimes which are asymptotically anti-de Sitter space, you can define, there is a well-defined total energy for the spacetime, and it was shown that if the spacetime globally approaches anti-de Sitter space, that energy cannot be negative. In fact, Breitenlohner and Friedman also showed that even in cases when you have tachyons, when you have a potential which goes negative, a bit, the total energy stays positive. Now, these positive energy theorems were proved using a generalization of Witten's proof of positive energy in the asymptotically flat case, and used spinners, which were, in an appropriate sense, asymptotically constant. But recently, people have been interested in cases where you have spacetimes which are locally anti-de Sitter, asymptotically, but not globally. In particular, Witten has suggested that you can describe non-supersymmetric gauge theories by using spacetimes which are asymptotically anti-de Sitter, compactified on a circle, where one imposes anti-periodic boundary conditions for the fermions going around that circle. We heard about that in the previous talk, and again yesterday in the talk by Yamran Oz. Now, these boundary conditions are not compatible with the existing positive energy theorems, and in fact, the positive energy theorems don't apply. In the asymptotically flat case, Witten showed that the Kaluza-Klein vacuum was not the unique state of zero energy if one imposes these boundary conditions that the fermions are anti-periodic around the circle at infinity. And in fact, he showed that the usual Kaluza-Klein vacuum was unstable. Sometime later, Dieter Brill and I showed how to easily construct solutions, non-singular solutions, which are asymptotically flat with these boundary conditions, with energy which can be arbitrarily negative. So even keeping the size of the circle at infinity fixed, one can find smooth solutions of five-dimensional general relativity, say, compactified on a circle in this way, with energy as small, as large and negative as you'd like. So this sector of the theory is just completely unstable. And the question is the same thing true if you add a negative cosmological constant? From a mathematical standpoint, this seems rather likely. Mathematicians often say that spaces of negative curvature are less constrained than spaces of positive curvature or spaces of zero curvature, say. And in fact, a little while ago, I called up Professor Yao and asked him this question of whether he thought these results would extend to the asymptotically anti-de Sitter case. And of course, he hadn't thought about this particular problem, but he gave me the following answer. Anything that is possible in asymptotically flat spacetimes should also be possible in asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetimes or asymptotically hyperbolic spacetimes. Well, this, of course, is extremely worrisome, because if it's true, this conjectured description of non-supersymmetric gauge theories is in serious trouble. Either the large N strongly coupled non-supersymmetric gauge theory is in fact unstable, and doesn't have a lowest energy state, or this correspondence is breaking down for these choice of boundary conditions. Well, I said a moment ago that there were solutions with negative energy, and so now let me give you an example. This is perhaps the simplest example. There are many others. I will work in five dimensions, so this is the simplest case of this Maldacena conjecture. And the solution that I'm going to look at is obtained by taking the near-extremal three-brain metric, going near the horizon, and doing a double analytic continuation. So I'm going to analytically continue the usual time into a space-like coordinate, and then analytically continue one of the usual space-like translational symmetries into a time coordinate. So the metric takes the following form. It's probably familiar to you now. U is the radial variable. L squared is essentially the cosmological constant. It's equal to 4 pi times the string coupling times n. This metric is only defined for u bigger than this constant u naught. It is, in fact, globally static. This metric has no horizons, no singularities. And this coordinate tau is periodic. U equals u naught is a, although that looks singular in these coordinates, it, of course, is a regular point of the geometry. It's simply an origin in polar coordinates in the u tau plane. And one can show that tau must have period given by this formula. So the period of tau is beta, which is just pi times L squared divided by u naught. Well, if you want to know what the energy of this solution is, the energy is supposed to come from the deviation of the metric from asymptotic, from the anti-de Sitter metric that it approaches asymptotically. So that's going to come from this term, and you expect the energy density to be proportional to u naught to the fourth. So that's 1 over beta to the fourth. But then you have to integrate over the surface at infinity. So you pick up 1 power of beta from integrating over tau, and of course a factor of the volume of this transverse xy plane. So you expect the answer to be proportional to this two-dimensional volume divided by beta cubed. And you do the calculation, and that's indeed exactly what you find, except there's a small surprise, and that is the sign of the energy. And as promised, the energy is negative. It turns out to be minus n squared pi squared, the volume of this two-dimensional transverse space, divided by 8 times beta cubed. The n squared arises just from the 1 over Newton's constant in the definition of the energy, and the fact that that's related to the square of the string coupling, and the string coupling is related to 1 over n. Okay, so here's a solution which is asymptotically anti-de Sitter locally, has negative total energy. Is that a problem? The answer is no. In fact, this is what we should have expected. It has a very simple interpretation in terms of the gauge theory. On the gauge theory side, what we have is simply Yang-Mills theory on a space which is topologically a circle across R2, but we've put anti-periodic boundary conditions around the circle. That, of course, breaks the supersymmetry, and we would expect this theory to have a negative Casimir energy. Well, one can compute that Casimir energy explicitly, at least in weak coupling, and you find that the Casimir energy of this weakly coupled Yang-Mills theory is minus n squared pi squared, the volume of the two-dimensional transverse space, divided by 6 beta cubed. So, in fact, the supergravity energy is 3/4 the Yang-Mills energy. And the question is, where have we seen something like this before? Well, as Igor Klebanov has reminded us yesterday, it's been known now for a couple years that if you take the near-extremal three-brain, and compute its entropy, what you find is that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the near-extremal three-brain is in fact 3/4 of the entropy that you would get from a weakly coupled Yang-Mills theory description. This was shown by Gupzer, Klebanoff, and Pete, and independently by Strominger. Now, this is not a coincidence. Okay, this is not really a surprise, although it came as a surprise to us before we stopped and thought about it for a few minutes. This is really something we should have expected all along, because it's the same functional integral which is giving us the Casimir energy and the entropy. You're doing a functional integral over a space, which is a circle, you know, cross R2, say, oh, and the circle cross R3, because we're including the time. It's the same Euclidean functional integral. If you interpret one of the directions of the R3 as Euclidean time, then you naturally get out the Casimir energy. If you interpret the circle as Euclidean time, you naturally get out the thermal partition function, which has a free energy from which you can compute the entropy. It's the same functional integral. It's the same Euclidean action of that solution, which gives a dominant contribution on the supergravity side. So the fact that these are related by the same factor of 3/4 is really not a surprise. But it does fit in, well, to the extent that the entropies are now thought to fit in with this correspondence and just indicate some small correction as you go from strong to weak coupling, it does fit in rather well with this correspondence between anti-de Sitter space and the gauge theory. But now we come to a key question. Now, I know it's been a long morning, and you're all probably eager for lunch, but if you've been daydreaming, now is the time to wake up, because this is really the key point. The key question is this solution that I was just talking about, which is this doubly analytically continued near-horizon geometry of the three-brain, okay, is that metric really the lowest energy solution with these boundary conditions for a given periodicity of the circle at infinity? And if so, there must be a new positive energy theorem, which says that consider any solution of Einstein's equation with negative cosmological constant with these boundary conditions. Its energy is always bigger than or equal to this particular negative value we saw a moment ago. And it's equal to this negative value if and only if the solution is given by this one. As a relativist, I can't tell you how bizarre that sounds. In all other cases that I know, a positive energy theorem exists when there's a minimum energy solution which is very symmetric. Okay, it's usually either flat space or anti-de Sitter space. This metric that we've been talking about is not that special. It doesn't have constant curvature. It's not supersymmetric. Why should this turn out to be the lowest possible energy of all solutions in this theory? It really seems very unlikely. This is on top of the general arguments I was giving at the beginning of this talk, showing that on general grounds, we expect asymptotically hyperbolic metrics to be no more constrained than asymptotically flat, and Yao's intuition that anything that you could do in the asymptotically flat case should be possible here. So it seems from all of these arguments that this should not be the lowest energy solution, that you should be able to find other solutions with perhaps arbitrarily negative energy. Well, if there's some other lower bound on the energy, we have the same problem. So let's suppose that the energy is either minimized by this one or there's no lower bound. Well, as I've already mentioned, as a string theorist, it seems rather unlikely that there would be solutions with arbitrarily low energy, because that would seem to imply that either the large N non-supersymmetric gauge theory is unstable or that this conjectured correspondence fails in this sector for these boundary conditions. I won't tell you how many times I've gone back and forth between these two possibilities trying to decide which one I think is right. I mean, both of them seem very unlikely. But logic dictates that one must be correct. As of today, at this moment, I am leaning toward the first possibility, and Rob Myers and I have found some evidence that this is in fact true. So let me just tell you a little bit about that evidence. So why might there be a new positive energy theorem in this case? Well, first of all, it's easy to show that if you take this solution and you perturb it to another nearby solution, at least to first order, the energy doesn't change. The solution extremizes the energy, and that's essentially a consequence of the fact that it's a static solution. More importantly, one can show that the solution is actually a local minimum of the energy. So to quadratic order, small fluctuations always increase the energy. So at least if you're interested in doing calculations around this background involving small fluctuations or small excitations, you'll be safe. There'll be no instabilities. This is something which was not true in the asymptotically flat case, where fluctuations did decrease the energy, even small ones. So what is sort of the key difference between the asymptotically flat case and the asymptotically ADS case, which might be responsible for this? And the key difference is really the following. In the asymptotically flat case, the circle approaches a constant radius at infinity, so that, for example, the five-dimensional metric approaches flat space like 1 over r, the same as the four-dimensional metric would approach a flat space. In the asymptotically anti-de Sitter case, the radius of the circle becomes very large at infinity. It grows, and in effect, the space decompactifies. That means that a five-dimensional metric with these boundary conditions approaches anti-de Sitter space like 1 over r squared, the same as a five-dimensional metric which has not been compactified. So in some sense, these boundary conditions of compactifying on a circle and putting antiperiodic boundary conditions on the fermions is sort of enough to get you a little bit of negative energy, but are sort of close enough to the globally asymptotically ADS case that it might actually not allow the energy to be unbounded from below. Well, if I had more time, and if people were interested, I could go into a little bit more detail as to why this sort of key difference may remove these instabilities. We certainly don't have a proof at this time of a positive energy theorem in this case. Let me just mention that there are generalizations of this positive energy theorem. Well, it's not a theorem yet. But there are generalizations of this negative energy solution, let me put it that way, that one could consider for other choices of boundary condition. For example, it's not too hard to show that there are negative energy supergravity solutions which correspond to a gauge theory on a circle across the two-sphere or a circle across any two-dimensional Riemann surface of higher genus. So you can find solutions. These are all five-dimensional solutions of Einstein's equation with negative cosmological constant, which asymptotically approach basically time across these spatial manifolds. Just to give you one example of this construction, for the case of a two-sphere across a circle, you can just take the five-dimensional Schwarzschild anti-de Sitter solution, doubly analytically continue again in the original time of Schwarzschild and in one of the angular variables, which will convert the three-dimensional sphere into a three-dimensional de Sitter space. If you do that, you get the right boundary conditions at infinity, and you compute the energy, and you find that it's negative. And here you see one of the differences between the ADS and the asymptotically flat case. This construction was precisely the one that Witten used in the asymptotically flat case to find another zero-energy solution, and in fact to find the instanton which caused the decay of the usual Kaluza-Klein vacuum. Here one finds that this solution doesn't have zero energy, it actually has negative energy, which can be interpreted as the Casimir energy of the gauge theory on S2 cross S1. Thanks. Well, I'm just basically done here. So let me conclude. There's basically just two conclusions. The first is that there are negative energy solutions, which are asymptotically approach anti-de Sitter space, which are just what we should have expected and just what we want to reflect the negative Casimir energy in the non-supersymmetric gauge theory. The second conclusion is that if we believe this ADS-CFT correspondence for this choice of boundary condition, we get a prediction for a new, and I've tried to emphasize, a very strange type of positive energy theorem in general relativity with negative cosmological constant. Thank you.
Questions?
Ed? I wonder whether in the asymptotically flat case there isn't an equally strange positive action theorem, which is believable and not proved properly. If you consider the Euclidean torsion of flat points, is it believed to be the most wild action object of this boundary condition? And otherwise, walking back into my tree.
The question briefly is there an analog novel positive energy theorem in asymptotically flat space? Positive action.
Okay, let me make a couple of comments. First of all, it's been shown that the usual positive action theorem, which was proved for metrics which are asymptotically Euclidean, fails when you replace that by asymptotically locally Euclidean. So just allowing periodic identifications on the sphere at infinity is enough to allow violations of that. So that's another case. I mean, it's like this this thing one could worry that if that was also true in the asymptotically ADS case, it would be another potential worry.
Your assertion is with unbroken supersymmetry?
I'm talking only about cases of broken supersymmetry. But I think your example of Euclidean Schwarzschild is a little bit different because there you're asking for an instanton and you would want to, it's a much stronger condition because you're solving the full Euclidean Einstein equations. To get these negative energies, you solve the Lorentzian equations, which are much easier because you basically have to only solve the constraints and are guaranteed solutions.
I know, but isn't there an assertion that the whole discussion of black holes is based on before, that Euclidean
okay.
Yes, Lenny.
It seems to me if it were any space which has a periodic structure in imaginary time is full of thermal radiation. Whenever you're full of thermal radiation, you have a Jeans instability. No. I'm talking about the asymptotically flat case. So even the Schwarzschild black hole, which is full of thermal radiation far away, is going to have a Jeans instability. It seems to me that what you're saying here, the existence of a positive energy field, is just a statement that there should be no Jeans instability in
No. This is different. I mean, it is true that large black holes in anti-de Sitter space are stable, okay, because there isn't this Jeans No, this is really quite different. In fact, this statement has nothing to do with black holes. You might think, well, everything I've done, I could just sort of analytically continue back and reconstruct a black hole space-time. But you can't, because most of these solutions will not be static. And so you will not expect to be able to analytically continue them back and reconstruct some sort of black hole. So this is a statement about excitations of this theory in anti-de Sitter, which on the face of it does not have anything to do with black holes. There's no horizons, certainly not in this sort of purported lowest energy solution.
I know, but exactly.
exactly the same traffic that goes from the Euclidean black hole.
Well, I think we'll have to see the result.
Other questions? Lee?
Yeah, another way for notes to violate positive energy in those two degrees of supergravity is to have the region in the middle where the metric is degenerate. How would the diagnosis know if it's true?
Well, that's part of the more general question of what do you do with singular solutions. And I've taken pains here to consider only non-singular solutions because those we know have to be included. There are certain cases where you can argue that some singular solutions should be there, perhaps where the singularities get resolved by stringy corrections or alpha prime corrections in the string theory. But, I mean... Oh, yeah. Oh, I certainly expect that. Right. I mean, no, the gauge theory on the boundary is very smart, right? It should know about, yeah, it knows about the interior.
Igor?
Well,
of course, the free energy is negative. And I think this is related to that comment that if you do it all in the Euclidean and you just do the calculation of the Euclidean action with the subtraction, the subtraction is what makes it negative, and then just currently identifies the negative energy. So it does not imply anything.
Yeah, I mean, this is, that was part of this comment. I made here when I was talking about the sort of same factor 3/4 coming up in both. Right, if it is the same partition function and the question of whether you're calculating this sort of zero, this negative energy, Casimir energy, or whether you're doing some the free energy is just whether you interpret the S1 as being the Euclidean time or you interpret one of these R directions as being the Euclidean time. So I agree with that. Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Eva?
Okay, I mean, I was looking at a classical instability that we would see in the supergravity limit. If you're asking whether these could get string loop corrections, sure, we have no supersymmetry, so I don't see any reason why there couldn't be further possible instabilities or modifications that way.
Well, I think it's time to thank the speaker.